and welcome to the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette and Fort Dodge Messenger for Monday, March 4th, 2024. I'm your reader, Mary Frances, and you are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. You can catch this and most of our local programming as a podcast on our website, which is iowaradioreading.org. As it happens with many Mondays in the Globe Gazette, there's little to no local news. On the front page, we have information. Congress announces a spending bill. It's mostly national. And then there is one kind of local story. Iowa Democrats quietly pick their 2024 nominee, forced to toss caucus voting by mail instead. This one reads, there's a lot less fanfare for Democrats in Iowa picking their presidential nominee this year. And it's not only because Democratic incumbent Joe Biden is in the White House. Instead of congregating for caucuses, a one-night spectacle where community members publicly signal their support for a candidate, Iowa Democrats headed to the mailbox to send in their ballot. The results will be released on Super Tuesday. That's a slate of primaries and caucuses across more than a dozen states. The break with five decades of tradition follows chaos that mired the party in 2020 and the reshuffling of the Democrats' 2024 calendar to prioritize more diverse states. The fallout has disappointed Iowa party leaders and activists, with some feeling jilted by the national party. Even more, it's left many worried about the deterioration of Democrats' grassroots organizing and about the prospects for success in a state that has morphed from a purple toss-up into a Republican stronghold over the last decade. Nancy Bobo, a longtime Democratic activist in Des Moines, was able to vote for a presidential nominee this year by mailing in her ballot, even though, for the first time since 1980, she was sick and could not make it to her caucus on January 15th. Nevertheless, the change is, quote, a thorn in my side, she said. Yeah, you vote, Bobo said, but you lose all that congregating and coming together and discussing issues. Bobo, an early supporter of then-Senator Barack Obama's campaign, recounted the record-breaking caucus on January 3, 2008, when so many people gathered at a high school that they were forced to move from the auditorium to the gymnasium. As a caucus chair for Obama, Bobo was responsible for wooing her peers, especially those who supported candidates that didn't attract 15% of the room, the Democrats' threshold for candidates to be considered viable. Quote, the excitement in the air was like nothing I'd ever experienced, Bobo said of the 2008 caucus. I doubt that what we do now is going to have much impact on the national scene at all, she said. In the lead-up to 2024, the Democratic National Committee decided to reorder the early voting states at Biden's request, prioritizing diverse voters in states like South Carolina and Michigan over the predominantly white voters in Iowa. Critics, including Biden, have said the caucuses are not representative of the party. The National Party has worked with Iowa Democrats, quote, to ensure a more accessible, equitable primary process, unquote, and is providing financial and other resources to strengthen state party infrastructure, said a DNC spokesperson in an email. While more than 200,000 Iowans participated in the 2008 contest that kicked off young Obama's ascent to the White House, that record-breaking number is a rarity on both sides of the aisle. Even during a contested race, participation in the caucuses is typically a modest fraction of the party's registered voters. Past plans to make the caucuses more accessible for voters who are older, have disabilities, work the night shift, or can't get childcare did not materialize. And then rushed revisions to the way precinct results were reported, at the party's behest, broke down on the night of the 2020 Democratic caucuses, leading to a failure to produce a clear, undisputed winner. Quote, there was a lot of drama in the way we've done it in the past, said Rita Hart, who is chair of the Iowa Democratic Party. Quote, some person's idea of excitement and drama is another person's total and complete chaos. What the Democratic Party needs to really focus on is the excitement, but make sure that it's very productive, unquote. While disappointed in the National Party's decision, the Iowa Democratic Party is reimagining the caucuses as an opportunity to reconsider how to encourage people to come and then engage in the kind of conversations that strengthen us as Democrats, Hart said. According to the party, more than 6,000 Iowa Democrats participated in the January 15 caucus, which was focused, among other things, on electing individuals to serve as delegates to the August Democratic National Convention in Chicago. They received more than 19,000 requests for presidential preference cards, which is higher than the number that participated in the 2012 Democratic caucuses. That's the last time there was a Democrat incumbent. As of Friday, more than 11,000 had been returned. Sherry Kiskunas of Waterloo had never actually voted in a caucus before this year. She was recruited to help run the caucus at her precinct in 2012. Before that, she, quote, didn't even know about them, she said. Even before the difficulties experienced in 2020, Kiskunas said caucuses can be messy. It wasn't so bad when I was vice chair because I wasn't in charge, but when I was the chair, it was horrible, she said. She recalled counting and recounting, people migrating from one candidate's supporters to another. One year, two precincts in one room added confusion. People get impatient and they want to leave, she said. I want to go home too, but the count has to be right. The quote-unquote easy mail-in ballot allowed her to vote this year. Still, she said, the party suffers. You don't have a chance to party build. You don't have that chance to for the interface like we had, she said. Sarah Riley, an attorney in Cedar Rapids, thinks moving away from a caucus format makes sense. She doesn't think engagement on the ground will diminish. Instead, a primary could lead more people to participate. Riley, who has volunteered hundreds of hours for presidential campaigns, said she doesn't think that energy goes away just because the method changes. Even with a different method of voting, returning to the early window could continue to bring presidential hopefuls to the rural Midwest state that has a more affordable media market. The Iowa Democratic Party has said it agreed to the changes this year only with reassurances that Iowa would be considered for the early set of states in 2028. But Bobo is skeptical. Once it's gone, she said, I think it's pretty hard to get it back. And that was the only local news piece in today's Globe Gazette. So I'll back into Sunday's, where there's really only one local article there as well. So this is from Sunday's Globe Gazette. House passes AEA bill. Measure would reorganize state special education structure and programs. Dateline Des Moines. A proposal by Iowa House Republicans to reorganize the funding and oversight of Iowa's area education agencies was passed out of the chamber on Thursday, the first major milestone for the proposal as lawmakers have spent the last 2 months weighing major changes to the state's special education network. House Republicans proposed the bill after they blocked a more expansive and dramatic proposal from Governor Kim Reynolds, a Republican, that would have allowed school districts to spend their special education dollars outside the AEAs. The House bill, House File 2612, would keep Iowa's AEAs as the sole provider of special education support in the state. State funding for special education services would go to the school districts, and they would be required to use that funding with the AEAs. School districts would receive their allocation for media services and other education services that are currently devoted to the AEAs, and they would be able to choose whether that money with the AEAs or with another party once the bill is fully phased in the 2026-27 school year. The bill passed out of the House 53-41 with only Republican votes. 9 Republicans joined Democrats in voting against the bill. House Education Committee Chair Skylar Wheeler of Hull said as he introduced the bill on the floor that it was the product of countless hours of conversation with stakeholders. He said there is broad agreement that changes need to be made to the AEA system. Quote, one thing was true throughout all of this. Everybody agreed that there were areas to improve and that we could make changes, he said. The AEAs have been included in this conversation more than anybody. We've worked diligently, and I'm proud of the work that we've done. In a statement after House lawmakers passed the bill, Reynolds said test scores and a needs assistance designation from the U.S. Department of Education show that the AEA system is failing Iowa students. Quote, the system must provide transparency and accountability to school districts, those closest to our students, and drive consistency across the AEA regions to improve services for students with disabilities, she said. That's what I've heard from over 100 school districts as I've traveled the state, and I look forward to more conversations as the legislation moves forward. Democrats said there is no need for changes to the AEA system, and that the call for changes was based on faulty assumptions about test scores and performance of students with disabilities. Democrats said they support the piece of the bill that calls for a task force to study the structure and services of the AEAs, but they did not want to make any changes before convening that study group. There's no reason for the rest of the bill, said Representative Sharon Sue Steckman, Democrat of Mason City. The task force will do it for us. Then next year, we can make an intelligent decision instead of a rushed one. Reynolds has cited scores for the National Assessment of Educational Progress, the NAEP, to explain the need for Iowa to improve its special education instruction. Iowa's students with disabilities have scored below the national average over the last several years, according to a report from Guidehouse, which is a Virginia-based firm that contracted with the state to study its special education services and created a report that suggested many of the changes in Reynolds' original bill. But Democrats said that test is taken by so few students with disabilities that it shouldn't be used to measure performance or the effectiveness of the AEAs. Around 530 students with individualized education plans took part in the most recent national survey. That's less than 1% of the state's students in special education. Quote, we don't know how the tested students were selected. We don't know if they were representative of all the students with disabilities, said Representative Monica Kurth, a Democrat of Davenport. She continued, but what we do know is that those students were about 1/3 of 1% of our students with disabilities. NAEP scores are one factor that the Federal Department of Education uses to determine whether states are properly educating students with disabilities. The Guidehouse report also found a 41% proficiency gap between Iowa students with disabilities and those without in the Iowa statewide assessment of student progress. Mike Baranek, who is the president of the Iowa State Education Association, which is the union representing the state's public school teachers, said in a statement that the bill is, quote, not as draconian as Reynolds' first proposal, but that it was still unnecessary. Quote, as this legislation moves forward, we implore the Senate and Governor Reynolds to commit to doing what's right for all Iowans and take no action that would reduce services for any students, he said. Doing anything else is irresponsible, unquote. Iowa's 9 AEAs, which are governmental agencies separate from the Department of Education, provide special education support to school districts in their boundaries and assist with classroom equipment and media services, professional development, and talented and gifted instruction, among other services. Right now, the services are largely funded by property taxes and federal special education dollars. Beyond the funding changes, the bill would bring the AEAs under the Department of Education and create a new state division of special education to oversee them. The division would handle oversight and federal and state compliance for educating students with disabilities. The bill would move the AEA's governing boards to an advisory capacity and require state approval of AEA budgets. The salary for AEA administrators would be capped at 125% of the average salary of all superintendents within that AEA's boundary. The bill would also establish a task force to study the AEAs, led by the legislative leaders of both parties. The group would assess and make recommendations related to the property owned by the AEAs, the services they provide, the accountability and oversight measures in place, the organizational structure of special education in Iowa, and a timeline for staffing modifications at the AEAs. Republicans amended the bill on the floor on Thursday that would bring back the option for school districts and AEAs to share staff like social workers and special education coordinators. The amendment also makes the number of regional employees in the State Division of Special Education flexible, with up to 40 employees split between the 9 AEAs. The division would hire 13 new employees based in Des Moines. Two Republicans who have in the past opposed some education priorities of their party said during debate that they were not thrilled about the bill, but they ultimately supported it because they did not think it would hurt special education offerings in the state. Representative Brent Ziegrest, who is a Republican from Council Bluffs, said he was not happy with how the bill came about, but that the House version was a major improvement. He said the bill gives him some heartburn, but that it is a step in the right direction. "It's fair to say this was on nobody's agenda coming into the session," he said. "None of us heard about it going door to door, but this issue was brought to us, and I congratulate Representative Wheeler and everyone else that's worked on this to try to make something that is certainly palatable to move ahead." Republicans widely opposed Reynolds' initial proposal to change the AEA system at the beginning of this year. Reynolds quickly proposed an amendment after receiving a flood of feedback from lawmakers and legislators, and that proposal has been amended further by the Senate. The Senate proposal, which is Senate File 2386, has moved out of committee, but it has not reached a floor vote. The bill differs significantly from the House proposal, and it would allow schools to seek special education services outside the AEAs. The chambers will need to agree on a single bill in order to send it to Reynolds to be signed into law. Wheeler said the criticism coming from Democrats revolved around the priorities and motivations of the governor's original bill and not the House bill. He said the House bill was not based on any test scores or the report that motivated Reynolds' proposal by Guidehouse, which is a Virginia-based firm. Wheeler said a number of school superintendents were on board with the bill, who said they would be able to personalize their special education services and spend their money more efficiently. He also noted that several organizations who were originally against the bill had switched their registration to undecided. Quote, "Giving them the money, letting them have the money and disperse it as they need throughout their school district, I believe that will improve outcomes for students," he said. Unquote. Wheeler, who has a daughter who has autism, said that he took the bill on early in the session because the issue was so personal. Quote, "I gave myself this bill not because I wanted to punish myself, not because I was the chair of the education committee and therefore I had to do it," he said. "I gave myself this bill because I believed if there's going to be something that affected my daughter's future directly, I was going to have my hands on it." And that was the only local story in the Sunday Mason City Globe Gazette. So now we'll back into Saturday. And on the front page, there's a photograph of a tiny baby wearing a mauve zip-up onesie and a little green frog hat. And the headline is, "Couple Welcomes Leapling. Only one in 1,461 people are born on Leap Day." Mercy One North Iowa Medical Center celebrated Leap Day on Thursday by welcoming a newborn to its birthing center. Baby girl Jolie was born to mom Lauren Volklander, age 22, and dad Nathan Hovel, age 20, of Mitchell on February 29. She's 8 pounds, 6 ounces, 20 inches long. Mom and baby are healthy and well. To commemorate the occasion, the family was presented with Leap Day apparel, specifically an infant frog hat. Understandably, frogs are the mascots for babies born on February 29, and they are fondly referred to as leaplings. "The staff and nurses had to run around to find her a little frog hat," Volklander said. "Her due date was March 4th, so we were expecting her then." Only one in 1,461 people are born on leap day. Most born on February 29 will choose to celebrate on the 28th or even March 1st as their birthday in off years. Bucklander said they already knew what a special thing it is to be born a leapling, and they plan to hold a big birthday party for Jolie every 4 years. Leap year exists, in large part, to keep the months in sync with annual events, including equinoxes and solstices, according to the Jet Propulsion Laboratory at the California Institute of Technology. Leap day is a correction to counter the fact that the Earth's orbit is not precisely 365 days a year. The trip takes about 6 hours longer than that, NASA says. Contrary to what some might believe, however, not every 4 years is a leap year. Adding a leap year, or a leap day rather, every 4 years would make the calendar longer by more than 44 minutes. Years divisible by 100 do not follow the 4-year leap day rule unless they are also divisible by 400. In the past 500 years, there was no leap day in the years 1700, 1800 and 1900, but the year 2000 did have one. In the next 500 years, if the practice is followed, there will be no leap day in the years 2100, 2200, 2300, and 2500. The next leap years are in the years 2028, 2032, and 2036. And turning to the inside of Saturday's Globe Gazette, trial set for Woden man accused of murdering wife. A Woden, maybe it's Woden, W-O-D-E-N, man arrested last fall on first-degree murder charges has received a trial date. Roger Laverne Cruz, Jr., age 56, is accused of killing his estranged wife sometime on October 27 or October 28 of 2023. The Hancock County Sheriff's Office, was dispatched to 633 Way Avenue in Woden for a welfare check at 11:11 a.m. on October 28. Upon entering the premises, deputies found Karen Abby Cruz, age 56, deceased. Her cause of death was not listed in the court filings. Roger and Karen Cruz were separated and living apart, the report said. Court documents identify Cruz as the individual who contacted law enforcement asking for a welfare check, admitting there had been a conflict and noting that Karen's physical condition was of concern after he left the scene. Trial has been set for July 24, 9 a.m. at the Hancock County Courthouse. Karen Cruz has accused Roger Cruz of burglarizing her home in August 2023, for which he faces separate felony charges. Trial for the burglary charge is set to begin Wednesday, May 1st. The investigation is being conducted by the Hancock County Sheriff's Office and Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation. Additional assistance provided by the Iowa State Patrol, Winnebago County Sheriff's Office, Lake Mills Police Department, Freeborn County Sheriff's Office, Albert Lee Police Department, and Hancock County Medical Examiner's Office. And it shows a mugshot of Mr. Cruz. Next story from Saturday's Metro shows a photograph of Timbercrest at Glen Oaks Community. It's, I can't tell if it's actually a drawing or a photograph. It's kind of overhead with the fields behind. Clear Lake's Glen Oaks receives recognition. Glen Oaks Community, an independent senior living community in Clear Lake, announced in a press release that it has been recognized with a Best of Senior Living 2024 award winner by A Place for Mom, which is the leading online platform and trusted advisory service for senior living in North America. The Best of Senior Living honor represents the top-rated senior living communities and in-home care providers across the U.S. and Canada, and it's determined by the reviews of residents and their families. A Place for Moms 2024 Best of Senior Living Awards recognizes the top 1 to 2% of nearly 45,000 senior care providers nationwide for providing exemplary care and support to aging seniors. It's a tremendous compliment to receive this honor from A Place for Mom, said One Vision CEO Mark Dodd in a statement. It reinforces our focus every day to create a community where our residents feel engaged, supported, and connected, from our on-site wellness center and pool to the variety of activities we bring on-site, to coordinating destination trips, such as to a dinner theater. This year's Best of Senior Living Awards recognizes top providers in nearly every state in several Canadian provinces, based on reviews from seniors and their loved ones. The top reviews, across aplaceformom.com, often highlight the excellent care and support senior living communities provide. A Place for Mom has found that on average, families are 6 times more likely to move into communities with recent reviews, further reinforcing the importance of reviews in helping families make decisions. Glen Oaks Community is a branch of One Vision that focuses on housing for active 55-plus living, featuring a choice of either apartment rentals or townhomes for purchase. Both living options offer a wide variety of amenities, from a full wellness center to organized activities. Glen Oaks is a 3-year winner of A Place for Mom's 2024 Best of Senior Living Award. And now we'll turn to obituaries from the Globe Gazette. There were no obituaries in Sunday or Monday's paper. This is from Saturday. Annette Pauline Scholl, that's S-C-H-O-L-L, born 1953. There is no date of death. But her services, a celebration of life, will be held Tuesday, March 19, from 4 to 7 p.m. at the Sacred Heart Catholic Parish Hall in Rockwell. Fullerton Funeral Home and Cremation Services of Rockwell are taking care of the arrangements. And our next obituary is Tammy Jean T.J. Hirv, H-I-R-V, age 53 of Rockford, Iowa, passed away Monday, February 26 at her home. Memorial services Friday, March 8, 11 a.m. at the Zion Lutheran Church in Rockford. A gathering of family and friends will be Thursday, March 7, from 5 to 7 p.m., and then again 1 hour prior to the services on Friday at the church. There's another story from Saturday's Globe Gazette. School worker fired for falsely accusing students of TikTok video. A teacher's assistant has been fired by an Eastern Iowa school for fabricating a story about a student making a TikTok video in a bathroom. Kelly Runge, or Runge, it's R-U-N-G-E, worked for the Central DeWitt Community School District as a full-time middle school special education associate from 2022 until December 2023, when she was fired for dishonesty related to a false accusation against a student. State records indicate that around 1 p.m. December 13, a student was reported missing from her middle school classroom. Principal Bill Petchy later found the student in the office and was told by the staff that Rung had reported catching the girl in the bathroom making a TikTok video when she was supposed to have been in class. The student denied the accusation and said no adults had entered the bathroom while she was there. Petchy then spoke with Runge, who repeated the accusation. The principal then reviewed the school's security camera footage of the hallway outside the bathroom where the student had been. He saw the student go into the bathroom and then saw the student leave, without anyone else entering or leaving the bathroom. 2 days later, when interviewed a second time, Rung allegedly reiterated that she had seen the student in the bathroom, making a TikTok. When informed, the video showed that she had never entered the bathroom while the girl was there. Rung said that she looked into the bathroom from the hallway and saw a cell phone on the sink and had concluded that the student was recording a TikTok. But because the video showed Rung nowhere near the bathroom entrance, Petchy discharged Rung for dishonesty. At a subsequent hearing on her claim for unemployment benefits, Runge asserted that while she had not seen anything involving the girl in the bathroom, as she claimed, she quote-unquote knew the student had made TikTok videos in the past. Petchy testified that the student was facing significant consequences, including a lengthy suspension of her right to carry a phone while at school, had the administration acted on those claims. He also testified that he had talked with Rung multiple times in the past about the manner in which her version of various events conflicted with what students were claiming. Students, for example, had previously accused her of calling them names and using profanity, allegations she denied. Administrative law judge Elizabeth Johnson ruled that Runge had committed workplace misconduct and was not entitled to jobless benefits. Quote, even after Petschy told Rung he knew she had not actually entered the bathroom, she persisted with the lie and maintained that she had witnessed the student making a TikTok in the bathroom, though she did not actually see the student, Johnson wrote in her decision. Rung was ordered to pay $1,176 in unemployment benefits that had already been collected. And we have a couple quick opinions, letters to the editor from Saturday's Globe Gazette. This first one is from Kevin Young of Sheffield. Kevin writes, Alabama Supreme Court Chief Justice Tom Parker is one of the most egregious examples of someone with no uterus who thinks he knows best for those who do have one. And that's from Kevin Young of Sheffield. And our next letter to the editor comes from Brenda Barr of Garner. Brenda writes, about 2 years ago, Summit stated that the intent of their project is to remove 1.2 million t of CO2 from Midwest ethanol plants. Recently, four more plants added will remove 4.7 million t for a grand total of 5.9 million t. The CO2 equals almost 1.4 billion gallons. Farmers should request the legislature to set a tax requiring 1 cent tax per gallon on waste CO2 removed from Midwest ethanol plants at the point that it goes into Summit's pipeline. This amount of money would be $14 million held in an interest-bearing account that would be the liability insurance policy for landowners who are unable to purchase liability insurance for their property because of the pollutant CO2 pipeline on their farmland. No one knows when a leak or explosion will occur. Plume modeling will not be released because it's a national security risk. So what's a life worth? I don't know the answer. I'm sure it will be a large sum. It should be. The fund should stay in effect like Summit's easement into perpetuity to provide landowners a small measure of peace of mind to farm. IUB should not permit this pipeline. There are too many unknowns. And that letter to the editor from Brenda Barr of Garner. And then there's a little political cartoon. There are two panels. In the first one, a white man with a white t-shirt and a Make America Great hat is standing there speaking, and it says, the economy is junk. I'd never vote for Biden. And then in the second panel, it shows him with a stack of cash that says $400 on it, and he is grinning as a pair of hands hold out a pair of golden shoes with the golden tennis shoes with the Trump logo on them. And that's all the time we have for today's Mason City Globe Gazette. You are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicap. I'm your reader, Mary Francis. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of people with print disabilities. And now we'll turn over to the Fort Dodge Messenger. And our first story from the Messenger, Child Care Gets Boost. Nestle donates $25,000 for child care center. And there's a photo from the exterior. It shows the former location for Becker Florists will soon become the home of Fort Dodge's newest child care center. The building will undergo extensive renovation. The child care center is expected to open in 2025. The effort to create a new child care center in Fort Dodge that could accommodate about 100 children got a boost from Nestle Purina Pet Care. The company gave $25,000 to Linking Families and Communities to help pay for converting the former Becker Florist store on Kenyon Road into a child care center. It says, at Purina, we strive to support crucial programs and partners in the communities we call home and continue to expand and invest in, said Trevor Morgan, the manager of the Nestle Purina Pet Care plant in Fort Dodge, in a written statement. He added, Linking Families and Communities is a vital organization for families with young children. It's an honor to support their work and purpose, he added. Elizabeth Stanek, the executive director of Linking Families and Communities, said the organization is appreciative of the support of the Purina Trust Fund and Purina Fort Dodge. She said the new facility will be called Sprouts Early Education and Development School. She said it will have 103 spots for children aged 6 weeks to 12 years old. It will have expanded hours to accommodate the 12-hour day shift and support, attract, and retain quality staff to increase the quality of childcare and education provided to the children that attend the center, she said. Linking Families and Communities bought the property at 407 Kenyon Road from the Kenyon Road Baptist Church in January. The greenhouse will be demolished, and the main building will be renovated and expanded. The Child Care Center is expected to open in 2025. And it shows a photo of some of the folks. We've got four people holding a big check for $25,000, a big fake check. Next story from the Messenger. It's nearly showtime. Grand opening set for April 19th at the Performing Arts Site at the ICCC. After nearly 2 years of work, Decker Auditorium and the Center for Performing Arts are nearly ready for their debut on the Iowa Central Community College campus. College officials announced Friday that the grand opening for the remodeled auditorium and the new Center for Performing Arts will take place April 19 at 4 p.m. The event will feature a ribbon cutting, tours, and performances by Iowa Central students and alumni. Quote, We take pride knowing this investment for our students in the Iowa Central Service Region will improve quality of life by providing new experiences to enjoy, said College President Jesse Ulrich in a written statement. His statement continues, With construction complete, the college will turn its focus to bringing in new acts to the stage and provide a state-of-the-art space for local groups, he added. Our region is fortunate to have a lot of local talent, and we look forward to partnering with those groups to take the stage at Iowa Central. It's just the beginning of a new era for our college and community. Our goal and intentions are to provide a space for everyone in our service area to enjoy and benefit from experiencing the arts firsthand and close to home. The renovation of the auditorium and the construction for the Center for Performing Arts is an $11.9 million project that began in August of 2022. The 1,200-seat auditorium was constructed in around 1978. No significant work has been done on it since then. As a result of the current project, it received new seating, an enhanced stage, theatrical lighting, modern audio equipment, and an updated electrical system. The new Center for Performing Arts was constructed immediately south of the auditorium. It includes a band room, theater room, classrooms, and a set building shop. Klinger Construction of Sioux City is the general contractor. Quote, We extend a heartfelt thank you to everyone that has made a gift to our Dream Big Act Now campaign for the auditorium and Center for the Performing Arts, said Mary Ludwig, who is the college's vice president for development and alumni. Don and Diane Decker of Fort Dodge made the lead gift of $1 million. Don Decker, chairman of the board of Decker Truckline, Inc., is a graduate of Iowa Central. The auditorium is named in honor of his parents. We're very fortunate to have the support of the Deckers, whose commitment and generosity has positively impacted the college and students for many years, Ludwig said. And it shows a couple of photos of the place under construction. Next story, Manson man killed when car hits ATV. A man was killed when his all-terrain vehicle he was driving was hit by a car Thursday afternoon on U.S. Highway 20 near the border of Calhoun and Webster counties. The Iowa State Patrol identified the man is Michael D. Leith, that's L-E-I-T-H, age 84, of Manson. The crash happened about 3:33 p.m. Thursday at the intersection of U.S. Highway 20 and Ziering Avenue in Calhoun County, the State Patrol reported. Leith was driving a 2020 John Deere ATV northbound on Ziering Avenue, and he failed to yield at the intersection with the highway, troopers reported. The ATV was hit by a 2007 Ford Taurus operated by William O. Peterson, age 88, of Moreland, which was eastbound on U.S. Highway 20, according to state troopers. Both vehicles ended up in the highway median east of the intersection. The Calhoun County Sheriff's Department, Nearham Greenfield Township Fire Department, Calhoun County Medical Examiner, and the Iowa Department of Transportation also responded to the crash. Our next story, cause of Friday garage fire under investigation. And it shows a photo of Fort Dodge firefighters working the scene of the garage fire at 955 South 20th Street. Fire department captain said the fire started near the bottom of a front corner of the garage and burned up to the roof before being extinguished. He said there was some heat damage in the garage. The cause of the fire remains under investigation as of Friday night. Next story, Fort Dodge native appointed to the bench in Cedar Rapids. A Fort Dodge native has been appointed to serve as a district court judge in the judicial district that includes Cedar Rapids. Mark D. Fisher, an attorney and magistrate, is the son of Monty and Deborah Fisher of Fort Dodge. Monty Fisher is an attorney who served as Webster County attorney from 1979 to 1982. Governor Kim Reynolds appointed Mark Fisher to the bench on February 21. He'll take office later this month, filling a vacancy created by the retirement of another judge. The Cedar Rapids resident will serve in Iowa's 6th Judicial District, which includes Benton, Iowa, Johnson, Jones, Linn, and Tama counties. He earned an associate degree in business administration from DMAC in Ankeny, and then earned a bachelor's degree in justice studies from Arizona State University in Tempe, Arizona. He graduated from the University of Iowa Law School in 2007. Mark Fisher has been a private practice attorney since 2007 and has been a magistrate for the last 5 years. He and his wife have 3 children. Our next story, a deserving recipient, REEC receives Growth Alliance's Catalyst Award. City staffer has had leading roles in many projects. And then it shows a picture of Vicki Reek of Fort Dodge holding and giving her granddaughter Bentley Kubler, age 2 of Fort Dodge, a hug and a kiss after receiving the Catalyst Award. Vicki Reek, a Fort Dodge city staffer who has had a leading role in just about every economic development and housing project in the community over the last 20 years, was honored Thursday evening with the top award presented by the Greater Fort Dodge Growth Alliance. REEC, the city's community and economic development manager, received the Catalyst Award at the Growth Alliance's annual dinner. After being handed the hefty sculpture that is the Catalyst Award, REEC spoke very briefly and softly, saying, "Thank you so much. I appreciate it." REEC has worked for the city for more than 35 years in various roles related to planning and development. Kelly Hindman, the vice president of the Growth Alliance Board who presented the award, says Reek's work is, quote, often behind the scenes as she negotiates development agreements, works on property acquisitions and dispositions, prepares financial pro formas, and calculates incentive packages. Hindman said Reek has been a key player and a key leader in these high-profile projects, such as the Decker Development Park, Williams Bend Housing Area, retaining Elanco in the community, and redeveloping Phillips Middle School, Crosstown Connector, Corridor Plaza, Parkview Housing Area, Northwest River District, Lincoln Neighborhood Redevelopment, and the Nestle Purina Pet Care Plant Expansion. Additionally, she's known across the state for her expertise with brownfield sites and environmental cleanup, even speaking at EPA conferences about her brownfield cleanup expertise. Over the years, she secured over $1 million in state and federal brownfield grants and services, which has been instrumental in the redevelopment of many areas of our community, Hindman said. REEC's service to the community is not limited to her professional roles. Hinman said she's active in these other capacities. She's a Main Street Fort Dodge volunteer, Meals on Wheels volunteer, community cleanup volunteer, Facing Autism annual Autism Awareness Walk volunteer participant, Midas Council of Governments board member, Fort Dodge Betterment Foundation board member, Greater Fort Dodge Growth Alliance Housing Committee member. What a deserving recipient, Hinman said. And then it shows a photo of Dawn Larson tearing up after finding out that her friend and co-worker Vicki Reek was receiving the Catalyst Award at the Greater Fort Dodge Growth Alliance annual dinner on Thursday. Our next story, Offenberger. Iowa Central official made special graduation for South African student. Writer Chuck Offenberger has had contact with Fort Dodge and Iowa Central Community College for decades. But one event at the college sticks out in his memory, and he recounted it for the audience at the Greater Fort Dodge Growth Alliance annual dinner on Thursday evening. In 1995, Offenberger, then a columnist for the Des Moines Register, accompanied opera singer and Iowa native Simon Estes to South Africa. There, he said they visited a school in a black township where children lived in poverty below our imagination, but the school had an outstanding choir. Estes arranged for some of those students to go to high school for 1 year in Iowa. Offenberger and his wife were the host parents for one girl who went to high school in Johnston where they lived at the time. That girl then returned to live with the Offenbergers while attending Iowa Central Community College. She earned her degree but could not stay for commencement. Her degree was issued the day before she was to return to South Africa. Offenberger described standing in an office in a building at the Fort Dodge campus while a secretary showed the newly printed degree. Then Tom Beneke, the college's vice president of student services and enroll management, walked in and asked what was going on. Offenberger explained the situation. He recalled Beneke saying something like, "It's too bad there's not a ceremony for her." He said the college vice president then found a graduation cap and gown, which the new graduate put on. Tom Beneke, on the spur of the moment, delivered a graduation speech for her, Offenberger said. The new graduate returned home to South Africa the next day with her degree in hand. Offenberger said he sometimes gets emotional repeating that story. In a related story, more on Chuck Offenberger at that Fort Dodge Alliance dinner. It says, many likely know Offenberger for his Iowa Boy columns chronicling small-town life or his unscientific polls attempting to determine who makes the best cinnamon rolls in the state. But over the years, he's done a lot more than write columns and sample tasty rolls. He's been involved in economic development in various ways for years. Based on those years of experience, Offenberger offered some advice to local leaders during Thursday evening's Greater Fort Dodge Growth Alliance annual dinner. I encourage you, invest, take risks, have fun, hope you get lucky, and if you're negative, we're going around you, he said. He said he's been just fascinated with economic development my whole adult life anyway. In the late 1990s, he served on a strategic planning commission appointed by then-Governor Tom Vilsack. That panel was tasked with preparing a plan for what Iowa should be like in 2010. According to Offenberger, one of the things that came out of that commission was the basic concept of what would become the Vision Iowa program, in which the state government would help pay for creating major attractions and amenities. He said the panel also addressed the need to reverse the declining population in Iowa. The commission, he said, recommended finding ways to keep Iowa's young people in the state and to retain people who came into Iowa to go to college. He said it also recommended increasing immigration. That one went nowhere, he said. It was too much of a hot potato. Offenberger now serves on the board of the Greene County Multicultural Resource Center. That's an organization intended to help reverse a century's worth of population declines, in part by working with immigrants. We're going to become that rare rural Iowa community that will reverse that century of population decline, he said. He said Greene County will have a multicultural workforce, applying old-fashioned Iowa hard work to make quality products. The jobs, he said, are there in Greene County. He said there are 200 to 300 jobs open right now that pay $20 an hour or higher. And turning to obituaries from the Fort Dodge Messenger, Dwayne McKenna, age 75, of Manson, passed away Friday, March 1st, at the Good Samaritan Society in Manson, with his beloved daughter Sissy by his side. Visitation will be held Saturday, March 9, from 3 to 5 p.m. at the Wishar Funeral Home in Manson. It says memorials may be left to the discretion of the family. Next is Carmen Hubble, age 85, of Pocahontas, formerly of Plover, passed away Tuesday, February 27, at Arlington Place in Pocahontas. Graveside service Friday, May 31st, 3 p.m. at the Powhatan Cemetery near Plover. A celebration of life gathering will follow the graveside service at the Spring Hills Country Club in Mallard, Iowa. William B. L. Wolf, W-O-L-F-F, age 90, passed away Thursday, February 29, at the Marion Home. Graveside services Tuesday, March 5, at 10 a.m. at the Memorial Park Cemetery, with military rites provided by the United States Navy Honor Guard in VFW Post 1856. Laufersweiler Funeral Home is serving the family. Alan L. Geerdes, that's G-E-E-R-D-E-S, age 80, passed away Sunday, March 3rd at Unity Point Health Trinity Regional Medical Center. Services are pending with the Laufersweiler Funeral Home. And Richard Clark Dick Johnson, also known as Uncle Dick, age 95, formerly from Fort Dodge, passed away Wednesday, February 21st in Great Falls, Montana. Laufersweiler Funeral Home is in charge of those arrangements. And we've got an opinion. This is from Representative Mike Sexton, a Republican of Rockwell City. He says, House looks at stronger history standards for students. We've been moving through bills at a rapid pace. These bills were what we call non-cons, which stands for non-controversial. Some of them are very simple bills, but there are some that are very complicated. But both the Republicans and the Democrats agree on the importance of the bill for the state of Iowa, so there's very little debate, if any. But once we get through the low-hanging fruit, things got a lot tougher. With the non-cons out of the way, we move on to issues that are more controversial. On these bills, the two parties just do not agree. This leads to very contentious debates with high emotions. Two of the busiest committees, which met last week, were Ways and Means and the Appropriations Committees. In the next few weeks, committees will get busy again as we deal with Senate bills that have come over to the House. You may recall, the first funnel kills any bills that did not pass out of committee in the chamber, where they were originated. So House files had to be passed out of House standing committees, and Senate files had to be passed out of Senate standing committees. The second funnel deadline is on week 10, which ends on Friday, March 15. This forces House files to be passed out of Senate committees and Senate files to be passed out of House committees. Bills that do not make it out of their respective committees will die in the second funnel. The Ag Committee did not meet last week or this week. We've only had one bill come over to us from the Senate. I received Senate File 2391 on Wednesday. This bill makes it illegal to label a product as meat if there's no meat in it. We're doing this so that Iowa consumers will not be misled by labeling when they think they are buying a meat product when it's really a plant-based product. The most controversial bills, which kept us here late last night, were dealing with education. House File 2545 would require the Iowa Department of Education to conduct a comprehensive review of the high school graduation requirements in K-12 core curriculum. A comprehensive review has not been conducted since 2007. House File 2544 creates new history and civics standards, which include a focus on American history, civics, geography, the American flag, national anthem, along with extended standards on Western civilization from Athens, Jerusalem, and Rome to the present, to understand the nature of our ideals and the institutions of liberty, how they came into existence, and what actions our forefathers took to preserve them. And that's all the time we have for today's Mason City Globe Gazette and Fort Dodge Messenger right here on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. I've been your reader, Mary Francis. Have a great day.